You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Good morning. This is Dori Francis with Every Voice Matters. How are you today? I do want to send a shout out and some prayers to some friends I have in the Lake Tahoe area. There's also a school there called Lake Preparatory Academy, and we are watching closely to make sure that they and their students are safe from this horrific Caldor fire that's happening in California. So if you believe in prayer and can send something out for them, I know Bill and the staff there at Lake Tahoe Preparatory School would be grateful. Today, I am really excited to have my guest, Janet Bentley, who is an author and an advocate, and she also manages the nonprofit foundation, Courageous Survivors. Janet was raised in Southern California and currently resides in Scottsdale, Arizona. She is a survivor of child sexual abuse, and her driving passion really is to be a lifeline to survivors, which we need so much of this, as we've found from the questions that were submitted for the show today. So many people are touched by the subject. So Janet has found that sharing her life story has been key to healing her own pain and also exposing the epidemic that we know that happens. She's written a memoir called Don't Expect Me to Cry, Refusing to Let Childhood Sexual Abuse Steal My Life. And it was published in October of 2018. You can get the book on Amazon. And as I always say, for anybody who would like to have the book, can't afford to get the book, please let me know. I will make sure that you get the book. She's been interviewed on several podcasts and so excited to have her live here today on LA Talk Radio. Thanks, Janet, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You know, it's such a powerful story, your book, and I think it has touched a lot of people just based on the questions that we've received. Shows a lot of resilience on your part, and you've dedicated your life now to just really assisting others. Can you just give us a brief introduction, maybe about when this started for you and how it is that you keep your passion alive? Because this is a hard area for a lot of people.
Yeah, it definitely is. Can you just clarify, you mean about like a short thing about my story or short?
Yes. Yeah, just a little short thing about your story.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so I am the oldest of eight children, and I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mom and dad were both alcoholics. My dad was a drug addict. My earliest memories of sexual abuse, which at the hands of my father, was at 4 years old. Being that we have eight children, you know, my mom was in and out of the hospital having children. She also had an illness, so she was in and out. And I was kind of left to care for the younger children as they arrived. There's way too much that happened to me, obviously, to mention it in this short time that we have. But there was severe and constant sexual abuse from my dad, from his drug addict friends, from family friends, from other members of the family, and then also at one of the churches. I look back now from where I'm at now, and I see that, and I understand that perpetrators kind of know how to spot the easy targets. And yeah. I think coming from where I came from, being very poor, there's a lot of emotional neglect, emotional abuse, you know, it just everything. And I think, you know, I was an easy target for them. And then, you know, as I got older and I got out of the house, I had never really, you know, disclosed to anybody, even my first husband, you know, about what had happened to me, and thought I had done a pretty good job of escaping that trauma. And, obviously,
had you done any therapy for yourself at all?
I didn't until after my mom died, which was in the early 90s, and I was in my early 30s. And I went to a psychiatrist that did therapy at the time, and yeah, it kind of started coming out. And once that little thing was open inside of me, it just came, you know,
floodgates,
flooding back, like memories and flashbacks, and it was a tough time. I was suicidal. For a couple of years, I was in and out of hospitals. Every antidepressant you could possibly think of was tried on me because I had severe depression. And yeah, and I found some coping strategies to deal with that, which weren't healthy, which was, you know, pills and eventually alcohol to medicate that pain that I was feeling. And that felt like it was inside of me and I couldn't just get away from it, you know, and that the only way that I could figure out at that time to get away from it was to use those medications.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to numb yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Eventually, I was divorced from my first husband and met my current husband. We've been married 23 years now. It was a blessing, such a blessing. He is an amazing, supportive man. And but, you know, we've had our struggles because that trauma was still there. It was still under the surface. I'd never really worked through it properly. And you know, we had a lot of moves because of his job. I had a cancer diagnosis in 2009, had treatment after that. And, you know, there were some tough times. And that eventually led us back to Arizona. And in 2014, end of 2014, I was suicidal again. I had, you know, I was drinking a lot and, you know, which doesn't help.
Repeating the trauma pattern.
Exactly. And sure. So I went to a trauma treatment center called The Meadows.
Okay. I'm very familiar with them.
Yeah. Pretty much saved my life. Was able to be accepted, learn about shame, learn about how to, you know, deal with shame, and was there for 45 days, went to the IOP after that, and then started pulling all my journals together to write my book, which obviously stirred up a lot of stuff. So even with all that I had then, I started drinking every night again to kind of disappear from that pain that was coming from writing the book and reliving everything. And beginning of 2017, I felt depressed again, and I didn't want to go there again. I really was ready, I think, finally in my 50s to start dealing with this. And so about 4.5 years ago, I started therapy with a trauma therapist. And I did a lot of research, made sure that I had someone that was familiar with Meadows that, you know, could kind of meet me where I was at. And, you know, the best we can do when we start new therapy.
Right.
I felt. And thank God it worked. And I have been with the same therapist, like I said, for 4.5 years now, and have made huge strides in healing. And that's kind of brought me to where I'm at today. So
Well, let's get to some of the questions that were submitted, and I'm sure that that will bring up also, you know, more information to talk about. And I do want to make sure at the end of the show that people, again, know how to get a hold of your book, and you've got several books, and, you know, to also do some research and where they can find, you know, the work on the foundation that, you're a part of as well. Okay. So Aaron in Vermont asks, at what age did you actually start seeing a future for yourself?
Well, you know, I believe that I had that sight of a future from a very young age, believe it or not.
No, I do believe that. Yeah.
You know,
seeing it and getting there are two different things.
Exactly. And, you know, definitely when I was old enough to get a job and make my own money and get a car. I think that's what helped me survive was that,
right,
that vision of getting out of this nightmare and into my own life. And I'm so grateful that I, for whatever reason, was given that little spark of hope and that just, you know, kind of willingness to keep pushing through and claw my way out of there. You know,
you just keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Andrew in Colorado says, or asks, how long did you think about writing your first book before you started?
You know, I think, I've kept journals ever since I was a kid, and luckily, through all the moves that we had and everything, I kept on to those. And I continued that when I started my therapy with that psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. But I think when I realized, and I think it was then, so it was about 23 years before, you know, where the idea kind of was planted in my head, and I just kept it there and kept my journals, and, you know, it was a lot of years before. A lot of years before I was brave enough to start that. So,
and, you know, when you say brave enough, is that because you were concerned about reliving or being re-triggered or having those things, yeah, reappear again? Angela in Colorado asks, you know, what are the signs that my child might be experiencing a trauma response to something?
That's a really good question, and really an important question. And, you know, I'm trained to do the Darkness of Light child sexual abuse prevention training. And one of the, you know, there's so many different things that can come into play there. But I think, you know, intense and ongoing emotional upset, inability to regulate themselves, mm-hmm. you know, anger,
just regression, behavioral outbursts.
Exactly. Yeah. Regression into, you know, emotional states that you know, aren't usual. Extreme shyness. There is so much that, and not all of those things necessarily mean that there might be abuse going on,
right,
or trauma going on. However, it's always best to err on the side of caution.
I agree.
And look into it.
Yeah.
So, and I have loads of information on child abuse prevention and all the signs to watch, and with information out to anybody that would want that.
That's great. We'll make sure at the end of the show that they know how to reach you for that assistance.
Awesome. Okay.
Anne-Marie in Utah says, I was abused as a child, and every holiday season I have flashbacks. I'm in my 50s now. Will this ever stop?
Yeah. Wow. I want to, you know, I think the holidays are tough for a lot of us that have abuse. For lots of reasons, many, many reasons. There's more alcohol, there's extended family around, there's, you know, more opportunity, kids are out of school, you know, just a million different reasons.
Yes, and all these wonderful movies that show you that, you know, life is perfect.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I have firsthand experience with this. One of my biggest traumas was on New Year's Eve, mm-hmm. where, you know, I was raped by my dad, by a drug friend of my dad. I was given to this drug dealer for payment, and my dad was in the same room. And I have struggled so long over New Year's Eve. And one thing I have learned from my trauma therapy and that I've really started to put into practice is that I don't have to be a victim to those flashbacks, those memories. There are things that I can do. There are tools. And one of the things I've done last year was to plan for it, you know,
be prepared.
I actually filled out a whole trauma plan, you know, trauma anniversary plan. And because when you're in the middle of the flashbacks or the trauma responses, you don't always have the ability
in that moment.
So the more things you can do ahead of time to plan for that, I think it doesn't necessarily make them go away, but we can be supported through it and get better at it.
And get better. Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than just try to avoid
cover it.
Cover
it up, avoid it, pretend it's not there. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Brian in Utah asks, what has been the most difficult challenge that you have faced personally through this journey?
You know, this is such an easy thing to answer for me. And it plays into so many different areas of my own sexual trauma is the inability to tolerate intimacy. Mm-hmm. Which is not just with your romantic partner, it's with friendships.
Right, like general, people in general.
Emotional intimacy. And obviously it does play into effect with my husband. And it's, you know, it's my greatest intimacy. We're all wired for connection and we need that. Even if we don't think we do, we need it. So all my years of shutting down and isolating, all it did, even though it felt at the time it was keeping me safe, it left me feeling lonely.
Right.
And because my greatest fear is my greatest need. And I am working pretty hard on that right now. But it is the scariest thing and the biggest challenge.
That trust factor.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is by far the most difficult thing for me.
Yeah. Chris in Idaho asks, you know, as a man, it is hard to talk about being raped. I was in my 20s. How do I move past this? I'm in my late 30s now and about to get married. And I think that is such an important question and, you know, brave for Chris to ask, number one. People tend to think that this is a female woman only situation. But I think it's what one in six men have been sexually abused. And it seems like they're less likely to even talk about it.
Absolutely. I have a very dear friend of mine that I met at the Meadows who had just disclosed for the very first time his sexual abuse. And I think men, you know, they do struggle with the same things that women struggle with, but I think there's an added layer of difficulty because, you know, men are, you know, they are dealing with stereotypes. And I think, you know, honestly, reactions.
Absolutely. Reactions from people. How can that be?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what I would suggest is RAIN, the Rape and Incest National Network. They have amazing information on there.
Okay.
Specifically directed towards the unique challenges that men have. And they are, I think they would be a real helpful resource.
And what about, you know, Chris mentions, you know, he's about to get married. What about sharing this with this person that you're getting ready to make this commitment to? I don't know whether Chris has or not, but I think that that would be a very valid concern going into a marriage.
Yeah. I think it's a trust thing.
It is.
Well, it's how well do you trust and are able to be vulnerable with that person? And hopefully, if it's, you know, my wish for Chris is that, you know, he does feel that connection and trust going into such a close relationship. Because otherwise, like in my
always going to be there. It's always going to be the other thing in the room.
And in my first marriage, I did not talk about it.
Yep.
So he had no idea some of the reactions and some of the things that would happen to me.
Why they were happening. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. It's a tough one. That's a really tough one.
And I will make sure when we put your page up on the website, that all of those resources that I know that you listed are there for people as well. So if you can't write everything down or if you're not listening live today, just know that we will make sure that all the resources are available for you. Clay in Utah asks, have your friendships suffered because of what happened to you? And I think you touched on that, you know, a little bit earlier about intimacy and friendships, making friendships, trusting people in your life absolutely does affect what happens.
It absolutely does. You know, I had such a wall, you know, such a wall that, you know, I would only let people so close. And if another person, a friend or whatever, made the tiniest mistake, it's like, okay, that's it. Bye.
An excuse to say goodbye.
So, you know, and that's not how relationships
right.
are, you right. know. So,
yeah. And people then don't know, they don't understand what's happening. Why did she react that way? I don't understand. Yeah.
They have no idea.
Yeah. Dal in Texas asks, how do you forgive someone who's hurt you?
It's tough. And, you know, I've only just started that process in this last therapy. And it even took me a couple of years to even get close to that. For me, you know, this is kind of funny. I had to look up the definition of forgiveness, you know, and one of the things that stood out to me was letting go. And that doesn't mean I'm condoning that person for doing that.
No, it's not about
letting go of that hatred.
Not the action. Yeah.
Yeah. And I felt like that hatred for so long held me together. And
yes.
I was afraid to let go of it.
Yeah, it was a burning drive to keep you going.
Absolutely. So it's scary to let go of that.
Yes.
However, it also kept me down.
Right.
And another thing that helped just really quickly was just to look at my abusers as other human beings.
Right.
Sick human beings.
Right.
You know,
mental
that
health and
maybe deserve to go to jail for the rest of their life,
yes.
but also sick.
Yep. It's one of the things that a therapist had recommended to me. A book that I read was Radical Forgiveness.
Oh.
And I actually did attend a Radical Forgiveness workshop, and it was very beneficial. In working on that aspect of forgiveness, but it takes a long time.
It does. I'm still working on it.
Dalton in Colorado asks, isn't it selfish to be so positive with yourself? Yeah. I feel selfish when I'm too good to myself.
I love that question.
I know. I relate.
Yeah, I do too. And it's,
do I deserve that?
Yeah, but you know, there's a definite difference between self-care and selfishness. And I look at, you know, self-compassion and being positive with myself as self-care, which right. helps me be more empathetic, you know, have more empathy for others, yeah. more kindness towards others, helps me be more of the person I want to be. But just to note that a lot of us that have severe trauma, it's very difficult to take good in.
To accept compliments.
Oh,
yes.
Gosh. And it comes in so many different forms. It's yep. very difficult. So, yeah, but it's not selfish.
No, it's just continued work. David in Utah asks, you know, why do some people develop PTSD after trauma and others don't?
you know, I'm not an expert on this. I just have my own experience.
Right.
I think, you know, what I understand, it's a lot of factors play into that. There's resilience factors. There's how you were brought up there. If your
support system,
exactly. Yeah. How you were reacted to when you disclosed any trauma, if you received support versus if you were shunned, you know, there's so many different things I think that can affect that.
Yeah. And, you know, how do you recognize PTSD? You know, also, you know, I say to David, maybe this, you know, whatever the situation is that he's asking about, it's not like we wear a shirt that says, you know, I have PTSD. Some people can hide it, you know, as you've talked about very well for, or at least feel like you're hiding it for a number of years.
Right.
And everybody processes and reacts differently to whatever their situation is.
Yeah, for sure.
Jackie in Colorado says, is part of trauma feeling numb?
Yeah, I think feeling numb is an effect of trauma. Absolutely. And you know, that was my main.
That's how you survived.
That's how I survived. Dissociation, yeah. You know, shutting down, you know, disconnecting from my body. You know, I remember my husband now several years ago saying, we were in the middle of kind, not a real argument, but just a heated discussion, basically. And I would just shut down completely, like in an instant.
Just like, stop. Yeah, I'm done. Yeah.
The raised voices mm-hmm. would trigger off my nervous system response. And he once said to me, how can you be so cold?
Mm.
And I remember thinking, I'm not cold. I don't feel cold. But if you think about it, That's what he was feeling
from you.
Yeah. So it's a definite trauma response and coping strategy.
Jason in Hawaii asks, you know, what affects self-compassion? I think some people have a real hard time with understanding actually what self-compassion is, how to take care of themselves, what self-care is. A lot of people just shut down, and it's a hard place to come back to or to even start, you know, especially when you're older.
Yeah. Self-compassion is so key, which is one of the reasons why I mentioned it. But it is, can be so difficult. Kristen Neff, I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she does so much work with self-compassion, and I have several of her books. And she defines self-compassion as kindness towards yourself versus criticizing yourself for being human. Common humanity, which is helpful because you realize that we're all flawed. We are part of this human race where we all are flawed.
There's no perfection here.
So being able to be kind towards ourselves and accept that. And then also being mindful of when we judge ourselves, you know, not kind of like what I've learned in therapy is I make friends with my coping strategies, whether it be self-criticism, whether it be whatever response I'm coping strategy I'm dealing with, because they saved my life at one point. Now I don't need them now. I'm not in the same danger as I was then.
Right.
So I have to teach my nervous system about that. And so self-compassion to me is it's key to that. It's key to the healing. It's key to realizing that little girl had no choice and that she deserves more than I'm allowing her. And it's difficult.
It's a long journey.
Yes, a long journey.
Jill in Georgia says, did speaking about what happened help you? I think speaking, writing, you know, journaling.
Yeah. It was very scary, like I said. When I went, I remember when it went live and it was actually published, and I had this little mini panic attack, you know.
Oh, like everybody's going to know now.
Yeah, but it's helped me. It's helped me in so many ways by not feeling alone, by helping others not feel alone, by giving me this motivation to, you know, advocate for the prevention of sexual abuse of children, of adults, you know. So yeah, it's helped me tremendously.
Good. Julie in Idaho says, you know, what was the one main reason you decided to write your book about what happened?
I think the same reason, but, you know, the main reason why I decided to do it is because I felt, and I can remember where I was sitting, and I can actually remember the feelings I felt when this happened to me, realizing that I could change my trauma from this horrific, it will always be horrific, but I could
absolutely
change this horrific thing that happened to me into something that could help others, which then made it positive. And I was kind of thrust out of this victim mentality that I didn't even realize I had been in for so long.
Yes. Yes.
Wishing for a different outcome. Well, I will never get a different outcome. That was my childhood. So, you know, I can use it to help others, which then it gave it a reason. It gave it some kind of
taking something negative
and
doing something positive with it.
And that was the main, that was the main reason why I was so motivated to do it.
That's wonderful. I'm so glad that you did.
Thank you.
Carla in Colorado asks, you know, will learning self-compassion skills make me an emotional mess? I think that's a great question, because
we're
working on our own things and stuff comes up. Yeah, it's going to be emotional and it's going to get messy. And that's part of the process.
Yeah. The good thing is that you learn tools as you're in that emotional mess. You can learn tools to help you through it. You know, and then you get better at it, and then you get a little less of an emotional mess the next time, and then a little bit less the next time. And yeah.
Do you think people avoid doing their work on healing because they're worried that the pain is going to just keep coming back and hitting them over and over and over again?
Yeah, absolutely. I know I did.
Yeah,
I definitely did. I avoided it for so many years. And yeah, it's like, it feels like the pain of it all is going to kill you, you know?
Don't outgrow it. Somebody actually asked me one time, well, if I wait long enough, will I just outgrow this? No.
No, unfortunately, no. Yeah.
Lauren in New Jersey asks, you know, I've heard of fight or flight, but when my trauma happened, I could not move or speak. It was if I was paralyzed. What does that mean?
That sounds like freeze to me. And that is one of the main, you know, responses to trauma.
So fight, flight, freeze.
Yeah. And animals, you know, animals do it in
absolutely.
In
yeah.
You know? And that was mine. You know, that's a complete shutdown. You actually have physiological things that, you know, your heart rate slows down. It's just a trauma response to a perceived danger, even if you're not in danger anymore.
Right.
The
pattern is there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it resurfaces again and again. Yep.
Yeah.
Mark in Colorado asks, you know, why is self-compassion so important? I think without it, we're just beating ourselves up.
Yeah. And I think honestly, without it, I think is one of the biggest reasons why I was so disconnected for so long from people, from everything, you know, just like observing life from this screen or something. I would push people away. It kept me isolated. And once I could start being kind to myself and feeling like I deserve a friend, or I deserve some happiness, you know, without that, you are just like on life support almost.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
So
Michelle in California asks, you know, will I become unmotivated by being so easy on myself?
I love that question. I still love it because for me anyways, self-compassion and it is one of the hardest things I've ever done. It's a lot of work. It's not being easy on myself.
Right.
So, yeah. There's a difference, a big difference.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know where her motivation comes from now, but I would say if you're being hard on yourself, yes, as you talked about, you know, sometimes that can be a motivator. It can fuel the fire, but eventually it's going to wear you out. And it can't last like that, you know. Well, it can, but life will sure be very challenging if you continue that way. So there's other ways to be motivated that can be helpful.
It's a very brave thing to do.
Yes.
To be honest, you know, so.
Millie in Utah says, I've been dealing with what happened to me as a teen for many years. Is it too late to look for help? I'm in my late 20s. And I'm thinking, oh, she's so young.
No, me too.
But it must feel like a lifetime for her also.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. So much. Wow. And, you know, I believed that I was too old to deal with it. And I should just buck up and
get through life.
Yep. Yeah, just whatever. But you know what? My life is so much more enjoyable now. I feel like I have a life. I'm living life rather than the opposite. Exactly. And oh my gosh, late 20s, so much life. So
I know.
Wonderful, positive things ahead of you.
So yes, there is still a lot of time, Millie, for you to get help. And we'll make sure that there's resources available for you to find and places for you to go and people for you to call and talk to. Yes, you've got hopefully a long life ahead of you that can be a lot more enjoyable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Monica in Washington asks, I know domestic violence is abuse. I lived with it for 9 years and I left. That was 5 years ago. And I still have not started my healing process. When do I begin? Sounds like Monica's just kind of existing right now.
Yeah. I grew up with domestic violence, you know, watching my parents beat each other up, and you know, it's very tough to be in that situation, as the victim, as the observer, whatever. But, you know, my suggestion is, you know, the hardest thing I think is asking for help, which I think you've already done by
just starting the process by
putting that out there and asking that question. And there's so much help, therapy, helplines for domestic violence. Helplines can even help you start that whole process of finding
resources. Pamela in New York says, will it ever go away? What happens if I do nothing about what happened to me when I was in college? I was date raped. I haven't gone to therapy yet. I haven't talked about it yet.
Well, it doesn't go away.
Right.
You know, it doesn't.
Talk about that. Yeah.
It's just kind of like you make a choice. You know, for me, it was therapy. You know, I'm not here to say therapy's for everybody, but I believe.
And the right therapist.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's an important part. A trauma-informed therapist.
Absolutely.
Therapist who understands about what happened to you, has experience in working with others. in regards to what happened to you.
Oh, that makes all the difference.
Yes.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
Reach out.
Yeah.
Rebecca in Utah says, I was abused as a child. How can I get a more compassionate view of myself?
You know what helped me big time was the inner child work. When I couldn't see how to even like myself, to look at like my granddaughters, very young, and or a friend if you don't have grandchildren, you know, whatever, and you know, put yourself in that position and think, you know, how would you treat a friend,
right?
You know, and try to treat yourself that way, which sounds really simple, and it's not always simple.
It's not always simple. You know,
it works. It works if you practice it, and it is a practice. You know,
Ryan in Utah says, "Did you write your book to help yourself heal?"
I didn't write it to heal. I wrote it, like I said, you know, to do something positive. However, it did. It did.
It had a healing effect.
Yeah, it definitely had a healing effect. Yeah. So.
And Sherry in Utah says, was it emotional writing your book?
Oh, extremely. Like I said, for the 2 years I was actually putting my journals together and writing it, I actually ended, even after being in the Meadows and everything, I ended up back in a psychiatric hospital for a week because I had got so depressed again. And it's burnt, you know, it motivated me to, I think it was that was my real bottom. It motivated me to, you know, find my trauma therapist and.
Yeah, really. I would think putting it, I mean, although you've been journaling, to actually be putting it into a format, you know, and writing those things again is triggering memories and can sometimes cause people to relive that trauma.
Right.
As they're trying to do something positive.
Yeah, for sure.
Thomas in Arizona, you know, asked, you know, how has trauma affected your life? I think you've talked about all the different ways that, you know, it has affected your relationships and your personal life. And Tony in Oklahoma asked, you know, I've heard the saying survivor to thriver. What does that mean? And I think victim as well. I hear, you know, a lot of people still call them, I'm a victim of this, I'm a victim of that. And, you know, moving from victim to maybe survivor, and then from survivor to thriver.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, surviving to me is when you, for me, it was when I began to have, when I was actively working on it, I began to have less depression, and I could actually visualize and see that I might get through this. And then thriving, and I go back and forth. I you know, it's not a linear path,
but right.
You know, thriving is then putting some of those things into practice and actually enjoying parts of your life and living it.
Trevor says, you know, Trevor from Utah says, so how does trauma affect the body? I think you've talked a little bit about all the different things, and it does affect your physical aspect as well. Unfortunately, a lot of anorexics, you know, or drug and alcohol usage. I mean, there are many different ways that trauma can affect your body.
I'm convinced that my cancer was caused from my early trauma, being in that constant stress.
Absolutely. And our last question is from Wendy in California, and she's asking, you know, how do I get rid of my critical voice? I'm still working on that.
Making friends, going, you know, making friends with that.
And being with positive people too, I think.
Yes.
Yes. Not being attracted to people, negative people who are going to, constitute that for you. Well, Janet, let's make sure, number one, people know how to reach out to you, where to find your books, and share with us the books that you've written, where to find information about your foundation. I'll also make sure that all of this is on your page that will go up tomorrow. But if you could share that for our listeners today.
Sure. You can find, well, my book is available on Amazon. That's the easiest place. I have books here that I can send out if someone wants to contact me directly.
Okay.
Go to my website, which is basically janetbentley.com. There's all the information on my book and the other books and where to get them.
Okay.
So that's that. And like I said, anybody, and my email is on there. You can contact me directly from my website. And I'm more than happy to get a book to anybody, even if they can't afford it. You know, give any resources that I've mentioned, I can send things to them. My Courageous Survivors, I have a nonprofit. I just got my 501(c)(3) status.
Congratulations. That's a chore in itself.
Yes. It's courageoussurvivors.org. And I'm working on a pretty cool announcement in the next couple weeks, like relaunching it.
Okay.
And because I've got like a shop on there coming and
there's, well, make sure you send that to me so I can put it up on the site as well.
And there's resource, so many resources on there, and they'll continue to be added. Lots of, and you can connect. It's going to be an awesome site. So
I'm so looking forward to continuing to follow that. I want to thank you so much for being here today. I think we could probably talk another hour, you know, on this subject. You know, it's just so many people, you know, in need and reaching out and at that point of needing to get help or in the midst of getting help, or perhaps you've done really well with getting help and you're ready to share and give back or volunteer. There's, you know, lots of opportunities for that as well. But I'd welcome you back again at any time, Janet. It's been a real pleasure to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And thank you to everybody that sent in questions. Those were such awesome questions.
Yes. And just know, you know, help is always available. It's there. So reach out to Janet, reach out to myself. We'll make sure that you get resources.
For sure.
Next week, we're going to have a guest, Suzanne Mortar, and she is with the International HSP Center. I'm actually not sure if she's going to be in Italy or the Netherlands. She lives in both places and goes back and forth, so it'll be fun to see where she's actually at next week when she's live on her show. And she's going to talk about highly sensitive children and what it's like to have a highly sensitive child, how it affects them in their education, and how it affects their relationships as well as highly sensitive people in this world. I want to leave you with this thought this week. Many folks are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. A quote from Abraham Lincoln. So I hope that you make up your minds that you deserve to be happy and that it is something that you can bring and welcome into your life. I'll see you all next week on Every Voice Matters. Take care.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.